Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what we've learned in 2012 from the scholars in the Scholar Circle. In January, on the two-year anniversary of Citizens United, we explored the decision's effects, the deeper issues, the possible solutions, and how we got here. Professor Scott Bowman gave us the history.
We got here through a series of Supreme Court decisions. People were shocked by Citizens United, but actually several things preceded that. 1978, in the Bilotti case, the court didn't formally extend First Amendment rights to the business corporation, but it sort of did it in a roundabout way in striking down a restriction on corporate expenditures in a referendum. But the court maintained after that expenditures in candidate elections were unconstitutional, and there's a federal statute that prohibits those, and that's basically the statute that was struck down in Citizens United. In the Austin case in 1990, the court upheld a similar limitation to the federal statute in Michigan. And at that point, the court put forth a novel theory. It's actually a theory it had sort of worked on in the previous case concerning the effects of corporate speech. They had to keep it in line in terms of precedent with the earlier argument in Bilotti that the reason you can limit contributions or expenditures for that matter is that it's somehow related to either a quid pro quo corruption or the appearance thereof. So what the court did is they extended that rationale, and they argued that the expenditure of large sums of money amassed through the corporate form constituted a type of corruption that distorted the marketplace of ideas. That became the new standard, and that was debated heavily at the time. And interestingly, Chief Justice Rehnquist was on the side of the majority. It was when Rehnquist left the court, Roberts came in, that everything began to change. So that was really the turning point. And then we see in some case law, in Wisconsin Right to Life case, a movement towards loosening restrictions that had been upheld on the McCain-Feingold legislation, and then that just sort of paved the way for this decision. It was a 5-4 decision in Austin. Interestingly, Rehnquist was a critical vote when he's replaced by Roberts. Many members of the court were prepared to do this for years. Scalia, Thomas had argued that it should have been overturned, Kennedy as well. So it doesn't surprise court watchers that it actually happened. Now, the other thing I would like to mention, the corporation had rights under the 14th Amendment going back to 1886. At least it was recognized as a person for purposes of property rights at that point. The idea, though, of giving it rights of speech is extraordinary, and you have to maintain that the corporation is a person in some sense beyond the legal fiction. The legal fiction argument is there, give them standing in court so they can sue and be sued with regard to property rights. So this is a very different matter.
Professor Daniel Green explains just some of the societal problems that arise with political capture.
Corporations have a different interest altogether, and it's really quite important to think about the difference between corporate contributions, which is the great innovation of Citizens United, as opposed to the older problem of the Supreme Court's equation of money with speech. It goes back now already a generation. The specific problem with corporations is that corporate donations are made by corporate managers who are bound by law to act in the interests of the corporation. Now, the law doesn't usually say what the interests of the corporation are, and so there's a certain amount of leeway here. But managers are directed to think about not the interests of the country and not their own interests, but the interests of the company. And the interests of the company will almost always be contrary to the interests of the economy as a whole and the interests of the country as a whole. In this sense, we need a dynamic economy in which new companies can innovate and can find new niches and create new products that create new jobs and new products, right? But incumbent companies, the existing companies, are almost always going to be threatened by innovation. And so what we're doing with Citizens United is we're creating an economic system that will use its power, and its power is huge, to change the law to create more economic power for the companies that already have economic power. You don't need to worry about an innovative product if you can simply get the legislature to pass a law saying it's illegal. If there is, in fact, a political movement that wants to restrain corporate power, there's no constitutional problem. The Constitution doesn't mention corporations anywhere.
Professor Daniel Green, again, on where the possible solutions lie.
Essentially, any state that chose to define this not as a problem of speech, but as a problem of who is entitled to spend corporate money, could, if it had the political will, solve the problem within the particular state simply by saying that corporations, of course, as the Supreme Supreme Court has said, are free to spend their money, but that doesn't mean that the corporate CEO or the corporate board is free to spend money that is not its own in pursuit of its own views. The money belongs to the corporation, and the states get to decide how corporations make their decisions. And all a state would have to do to completely solve the entire problem would be to pass a law saying if a corporation wants to spend money to influence an election, it has to first take a poll of its employees and its customers to determine how they would like their money spent. And there's no possibility that any American corporation would agree to do that. They would simply opt out of the system.
Twice during the year, we analyzed the issue of inequality, both here in the U.S. and comparatively. Professor Lane Kenworthy elaborated.
Earnings for those at the low end of the distribution have risen by a very small amount. It's also the case for household incomes. It's the case for other measures, too, if you look at consumption, for example. So all of these measures, they'll differ a little bit, but they're all telling essentially the same story, which is for people in the bottom quarter of the distribution or even in the bottom half, there's been very little income, earnings, consumption, arguably broader well-being, although that's a little more contested, gain over the last generation, despite an awful lot of economic growth. Our economy hasn't grown quite as fast as it did in the several decades right after World War II, but it's grown quite rapidly, and yet not a lot of that growth has trickled down to those in the lower half of the distribution. So the amount of income in the economy goes up, but if a larger and larger share is going to those at the very top, that leaves inevitably less for those in the middle and at the lower end. One way of thinking about this might be to say, well, look, that's just the new reality in the new economy. It's a different world now than it was back in the 50s, 60s, and early 1970s. It's a much more competitive, much more internationalized economy. We have a very different system of corporate governance now. We have a lot of technological change, and all of these things arguably both put pressure on management to control costs in a way that just didn't exist before, and also make life tougher for those with limited skills because they face more competition both abroad and also within this country and additionally from machines. So maybe that's just the way life is. And yet, when I look across the rich countries, I don't see the same pattern replicated everywhere. There are a few other countries where things have played out more or less similarly to the way they have here, not quite as extreme as here. But those countries are actually a minority. More than half of the 20 or so rich countries around the world have seen a very different process, much like we did in the 1950s and 60s, where a good chunk of the economic growth does trickle down to households in the lower half. It happens in various ways. It's through increases in earnings and also from a steady increase in government transfers. So part of the population in any rich country inevitably depends on government transfers, whether it's pensions or unemployment insurance or sickness or disability payments or what we usually call TANF and food stamps that go to the very poorest who aren't working. Countries face a choice about when the economies are growing. Do we increase the generosity of these benefits a little bit so that those who are dependent on them can more or less keep up with everyone else, or do we not? And for the most part, with the exception of Social Security and the Earned Income Tax Credit, we in the United States really haven't done that. And that's one of the things that separates us from the other countries that I looked at.
Professor Miles Corak focused on three key factors in inequality.
Certainly first, what's happening at the lower end. This is no surprise to anyone who's versed in the decline of manufacturing and the decline of certain institutions like unions. There's less growth in the incomes of people with lower levels of skills and education. And that's what's preventing the lower end from moving up. At the same time, globalization and technical change have really changed in a fundamental way. And again, this is more so in the U.S. than in other countries. The returns to higher education and particularly education from certain schools and certain fields, so that the top 20% or so have seen significant increases in their labor market outcomes. If you lay on top of that the total share of earnings made in the U.S. and in other Anglophone-speaking countries that accrue to the top 1% and even less, the top 0.1%, have really ballooned quite dramatically since the 1980s. And that has been a very important factor in increasing overall measures of inequality. Now, what to do about this if there is a good deal of equality of opportunity, if children raised at any point in the income distribution can aspire to become all that they could be, then we might not be as concerned about these types of inequality. And I think for a long time there's been a certain disconnect in the American psyche where we accept a certain amount of inequality at a point in time because we believe that there is mobility over time and over generations. That disconnect or that perception is starting to change. There has to be concern about the growing share in the top 1%, whether that is merited, whether that influences how you structure other institutions, be it transfer programs, be it the financing of education systems, be it the structuring of political mechanisms for change.
Then in March, after election results were announced in Russia, its citizens rose en masse in protest. Professor Robert English explained the dynamics.
There have been a number of anti-corruption campaigns launched. Certainly, current president Medvedev has made this a centerpiece of his intended policies. And when there have been particularly egregious scandals in certain police departments or ministries, people have been sacked, people have been prosecuted, but they haven't made any real headway. This is one of the most serious sources of discontent. Certainly the savvy, educated urban elites. Maybe it's more about dignity and a political voice. But for ordinary Russians, it's corruption and bureaucracy. Russians have had a corrupt system for centuries. This is not to say that it's not a serious problem, but just that we shouldn't expect, or they don't even demand, anything as clean or as efficient as we're used to thinking about. You know, it will remain corrupt. It will take centuries to change cultural patterns as well as sort of administrative institutional incentives. Finally, I don't know, I would kind of split the corruption into two main problems or manifestations. One is what I just said, public discontent, anger, frustration at the degrading and tiring daily life. The second is the corruption that does or doesn't affect the economy. And as long as they're exporting oil and the prices remain that high, and foreign companies are willing to come in and deal with that kind of corruption and manipulation on that level and still make a really healthy profit, then I don't see it really hurting the economy, the larger, you know, the rate of inflation, growth, and so forth, in any significant way. Look at the level of FDI, foreign direct investment in Russia. It's more responsive to oil and to certain changes in law that permit this or that kind of deal than it is to sort of the petty daily degradation and humiliation affect individuals. It doesn't stop business, and that's booming.
And just how do we place Russia within a global context? Professor Catherine Stoner Weiss.
In terms of the relationship with the West, with oil and natural gas, Russia is the world's leading producer of oil. It's not always the world's leading exporter because it has such a large domestic demand as well. So the situation has been created that Western Europe is increasingly dependent on Russian oil. And if Iran goes ahead and, you know, geopolitics are connected, if Iran goes ahead and you know, cut off Italy and, you know, a bunch of other countries from Iranian oil exports, then where do the Europeans turn to make up the difference? Most likely they would turn to Russia. And Russia's already supplying a great deal of oil and natural gas, in particular, to Western Europe. So Germany is shockingly dependent, for example, Europe's largest economy, on Russia for natural gas supplies. And in the past, Russia has not been above kind of using this kind of energy dependence as a tool to thrash other former Soviet republics or try to beat them into submission, and perhaps most notable here has been Ukraine. That's maybe unlikely to happen right now, but certainly Germany's economy is quite vulnerable, and as we're watching with the European financial crisis that has been spreading, this begins to affect us to some degree as well. The other issue is Russia's relations with China and its energy relations with China, which is a counterbalance, I suppose, to Western influence globally. So if oil prices go higher and higher and we continue to have trouble in the Middle East and trouble with Iran, you know, Russia becomes more and more powerful and strategically important in the energy sector in particular. And in the past, we've seen it become more aggressive in terms of its more general foreign policy as oil prices go up. There's at least a correlation.
We turned back to the U.S. and tried to get to the bottom of why millions of people are without a place to call home. Professor Sam Tsimbaras explained some of the leading factors that lead to homelessness.
Historically, since the 80s in this country, since the Reagan administration, the income disparity in the United States has gone from 0.30 to 0.47, meaning that the difference between rich and poor is growing every year. Now, why that's important is that that kind of income disparity is correlated to social problems, homelessness being among them. So that we have, since the 1980s, this steady increase in the number of people homeless, and families are the fastest growing number. Most painful in that story is the fact that in the New York City shelter system, where about 28,000 families, which is 90% women with children, show up, the primary reason they get for being homeless is that their child got sick. So the child gets sick, either you take off work, you lose your job because you're taking care of your kid, or you have to pay the doctor's bill and you can't pay the rent, and you end up in the shelter system. So that the homelessness is just sort of the tip of an iceberg of income disparity, no national health plan, no living wage. You know, it's just sort of the what we see above the surface of structural problems that are generating more and more homeless people, and we're not really even talking about the foundational problems that keep contributing to this homelessness issue.
Professor James Bumal adds this.
There's a significant portion of homeless people, if we're talking about people in shelters, who have a reasonably recent history of serious mental illness. But the thing to keep in mind is that the vast majority of people with serious mental illnesses are not homeless. So to characterize the problem that way is to misread the connection between material well-being and the ability to stay in a home.
Again, Sam Tsimbaris.
There is certainly a relationship between homelessness and mental illness in the same way that there's a relationship between homelessness and anybody else. So when you're homeless, you're going to get a lot worse. But the relationship between homelessness and mental illness is not a psychiatric or mental health relationship. It's an economic relationship, primarily, because people who have a severe psychiatric disability are on Social Security or disability income, which is among the lowest incomes. I mean, welfare is even lower than that. But currently, people are getting something like $700 a month for their entire expenses. That includes lodging and food and medicine if they're taking it and so on. So that the people who are most at risk are the poorest of people, and among the poorest are people on fixed income. So when simple things happen like their lease is renewed and the rent goes up by 3% or 5%, that is a risk factor for bringing them into homelessness.
And as for society's response, Professor Kim Hopper says this.
I think in part a great deal of accommodating activity goes on sort of backstage. And so the part of society's response that we don't see are all those people who are doubling up with friends and family, often on extremely long periods of time, that attest to a kind of moral economy of helping one another out that very rarely gets any credit. But if it weren't there, the burden on public shelter facilities would be astronomical. It would just be completely insupportable. On the other hand, in the public spaces, there's pretty much an unwritten law that, for the most part, at least from the 1970s on, the idea of an overt spectacle of pain being part of the urban landscape has been really not the best way of advertising your city. So rendering people invisible, either through shelters or through the destruction of shanty towns or through just buying people a bus ticket someplace else, has been a very common practice. But that's, I think, only the tip of a much larger story about ordinary folks are helping each other out so that the public relief system can actually work.
Again, James Bumal.
It's trite to say that it's just not a priority. But in many respects, that's the case. And to the extent that we associate homelessness with public disorder, addiction, with mental illness, and we mistake an economic problem for something else. And in that respect, I think the media have failed us and failed homeless people in some ways. And quite honestly, my colleagues in academia have largely been bought off by technical studies and interest in technical small fixes for program interventions. And while I wouldn't argue that that isn't necessary, we know how to rehouse people.
And it simply requires the political will to do so, and that requires a movement behind it that has flagged badly.
Again, James Bummel.
And that involves them in making invidious distinction after invidious distinction, putting the burden on people to prove that they are so colossally desperate that they will do anything to get what you have to offer. And we do that because we think otherwise we're going to be cheated, that we're going to be taken advantage of. And we focus on the very small number of people who have that attitude, instead of understanding that by focusing policy on that very small number of people, we're missing the point, and we are failing to serve adequately or support adequately the vast majority of people who are in trouble.
In May, the International Criminal Court convicted Liberian President Charles Taylor. What did the conviction reveal about the international justice system? Professor David Kay gives us the background.
The tribunal was established by an agreement between the United Nations and the government of Sierra Leone. So it's a special tribunal. It's actually called the Special Court for Sierra Leone. It was specifically established in order to deal with the crimes that were committed during the civil war in Sierra Leone in the late 90s and early part of this century. And it's special in the sense that we really only have a couple of these hybrid tribunals out there. You know, there's the International Criminal Court, which is truly an international court under international law that was established by a treaty. And we have the former or the ad hoc tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda that were established by the United Nations Security Council. But this kind of special approach of a hybrid tribunal that actually brings together Sierra Leonean law and international law, brings together personnel from both Sierra Leone and from the international community, both in terms of judges, prosecutors, defense counsel, clerks, and registry officers, is really something interesting and is an important way to think about international justice really getting incorporated into a national system, particularly in a post-conflict setting like Sierra Leone, where its judiciary would probably not be capable of handling this kind of thing on its own.
Some scholars think that the conviction, and indeed the International Criminal Court's entire approach, is an inadequate process for true justice. Professor Mark Drumble explains.
I think we need to ask ourselves a question, which is really, in a post-conflict situation, what does justice mean? And it's easy to say that a conviction equates justice, and clearly that's the case here. He's convicted on 11 counts of crimes against humanity and war crimes. But at the end of the day, it's important for us to take a step back and say, how are the justice interests of people on the ground in Sierra Leone necessarily advanced by this? And it's important for us not to put too much faith into a criminal conviction. But, you know, for former child soldiers in Sierra Leone, for devastated communities, for elements of society that are trying to rebuild, a criminal conviction in a distant court can be very symbolic. It can also be very expensive, but it can also, at the same time, distract from what really needs to happen on the ground in terms of reintegration, rehabilitation, community reconstruction, and so forth. So I think as people concerned about justice, we need to be circumspect about how much criminal law can advance us towards justice. And if we stop now thinking about what justice means for Sierra Leone and West Africa in general, we're selling ourselves short and we're stopping prematurely. We're failing to realize that there's the already tremendous level of selectivity in what we understand justice to mean, namely Western-style criminal trials. And I think if we truly think of a pluralistic understanding of justice, we need to do a lot more in terms of bringing in alternate forms of dispute resolution, truth commissions, reparations, in the context of Sierra Leone, completely irrelevant to, in many ways, the notion of individual guilt, is the structural factors that help support violence in Sierra Leone. The blood diamond trade, for example, intercessions of Western powers or failures to intercede. And these are all factors that conspire together and allow atrocity to become truly massive.
Professor Hannah Gary adds this.
There is a danger with the focus over the last 15, 20 years on international criminal law and tribunals, hybrid or international criminal law trials at the national level as being the answer, the main way to get justice. There are other understandings of justice, and we really need to have a more nuanced contextual approach with respect to that understanding, and also the realization that in different parts of the world, justice means different things for different communities. Also, there's the danger that we say we got that conviction and our job is done as the international community in working with a post-conflict society and not moving forward to address the root causes and the deeper problems that led to the conflict and the crimes in the first place. That being said, that I do think that there is a universal sense among victims around the world that these trials are important, that it is important for us to, as the international community, to say enough with impunity. And even though that justice is selective, not everyone is tried that should be tried. Moving forward, taking steps towards trying some of the most senior leaders is important, and it's imperfect, but we continue to try, and with a permanent international criminal court, with the complementarity regime, hopefully we're closing the gaps with respect to some of that selectivity. And there are more convictions being reached, hopefully in the future. And at the same time, other forms of justice being addressed, such as restorative justice with getting victims more involved, awarding of reparations. I do want to sort of hold to the idea that it's still critically important and that international criminal trials are not necessarily just a Western position on the world.
With the conviction of President Charles Taylor and with the 10-year anniversary of the International Criminal Court, we took a closer look inside the operations with Chris Mahoney.
I guess the first thing to consider is the legitimacy of the cases that the court does prosecute, particularly in the context of the crimes committed elsewhere. And so the court is able to assert jurisdiction or be granted jurisdiction in three ways. And the first is where a state's party to the Rome Statute, that's a state that has signed up to the Rome Statute, refers a case to the court. And the second is where a state perhaps does not refer a case of crimes committed within its territory to the court, and the prosecutor then asserts jurisdiction over those crimes, what we call proprio moto, effectively by his own volition. And that's then confirmed by the pretrial chamber of the court. And the third is where the Security Council refers a case to the ICC. And as we've seen in Sudan and Libya, they can refer cases that occur within states that have not signed up to the ICC. And so particularly in those instances, we're seeing a backlash, particularly from the African Union, where in the case of Sudan, and perhaps possibly if things had not concluded the way they did in Libya, the AU has said, well, we're not going to cooperate with investigations into the case of Sudan because we view it as politicized. And however, of course, that presumes that where states refer cases to the ICC, there's not an element of politicization there. And this is really one of the key structural changes from the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda or the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, where the Security Council effectively had power, wielded the power, and exercised the power to create these international institutions of justice to prosecute particular crimes committed in particular territories at particular times. And the creation of these courts was, of course, selective because crimes were committed elsewhere also, but institutions of criminal international criminal justice were not created to deal with those. So in terms of the capacity of states within Africa, whether it's Uganda or the Democratic Republic of Congo or the Central African Republic or indeed the Ivory Coast more recently, these African governments now have the same capacity to refer particular crimes committed within their territories to the ICC. And I think we're seeing some of the same levers of pressure in the sense that the governments that refer the cases are able to negotiate referral in such a way as to protect themselves from prosecution whilst deploying the court against their adversaries. That certainly appears to be the case in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Uganda, and it's really reflecting particularly what we saw in Sierra Leone, where the Special Court for Sierra Leone was deployed disproportionately against Charles Taylor, and the same threshold was not employed to consider those supporting crimes committed by the civil defense forces, the forces fighting against the rebels that Charles Taylor was supporting.
We also explored alternatives to the International Criminal Court. Professor Mark Drumble.
It would be one that I would describe as cosmopolitan pluralist. And by that I mean this. We share common values in holding offenders who commit crimes against humanity, genocide, and war crimes. We share a cosmopolitan common interest in holding them accountable. But we should develop a pluralistic framework about the processes by which accountability is meted out and measured and implemented. But what has happened is that when we close our eyes and look at the imagined space of what justice is or ought to be, we see courtrooms, we see judges, we see witness boxes, we see cross-examination, and then we see jails. We see a framework of justice as being defined by law, and as law, in particular criminal law, as defining justice. And if I had to start from scratch and redo the entire system, if there was a cave I could go in or a veil I could pull down, what it would look like would be one in which there was no defining iconicity towards the courtroom or the jailhouse, but rather we just appreciated justice as taking multiple forms in multiple places, often through methods that are radically different one from the other. And it would be a system where there would be more bottom-up input. Through my work in Rwanda, for example, I became increasingly skeptical of the reordering possibilities of retributive criminal trials and became more engaged with restorative modalities of justice. And I would like to see more of that within an overall framework.
In July, international leaders discussed how to deal with the climate change issue. We engaged top scientists and policy thinkers about how to move the entire world to renewable energy. Professor Mark Jacobson joined us to explain how this can be done and what the obstacles are.
We think it's technically feasible to repower the world in terms of the resources, materials, even costs. Whether it happens or not will depend a lot on politics and whether people really want to do it and try to change the subsidy system. But in terms of looking at the big picture, right now, if we look at the end-use power demand worldwide, it's about 12.5 terawatts. In 2030, with business as usual, if population goes up and we keep using more energy, it's estimated to be about 17 terawatts. It turns out if we convert the entire energy infrastructure for all purposes, that's electricity, for heating and cooling, for transportation, and for industrial processes, if we convert it to electricity and electricity-derived hydrogen, so convert all, for example, combustion vehicles to electric vehicles or some hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, if we convert any combustion process to an electric process, the total power demand goes down by about 32% worldwide to 11.5 terawatts. In fact, in the United States, it would go down by 37% just because of the efficiency of electricity. To get that 11.5 terawatts, what do you need and what kind of resources do you need? So we figured that we could do it with about 50% wind, 40% solar, and 10% all the other clean renewables. And we looked at how many devices you would need and how much land you would need for this. And these are not large numbers when you consider this magnitude of what we're trying to do. For example, it's about 4 million 5-megawatt wind turbines to do 50% of the world. In World War II, the world produced about 800,000 airplanes in 4 or 5 years. So 4 million wind turbines, it's not really out of our reach. But to actually do that, it takes a lot of political willpower. And there's so many competing interests in the natural gas, because natural gas prices are low now, and also still with coal in many countries, and oil is not going away very quickly. So I think that's the big challenge, is how to convince people to, even if they're the same price, say wind, and which is, I mean, wind is the second largest new source of electric power in the U.S. on average for the last 5 years. And this last year, wind plus solar were 68% of all of Europe's new electric power. But there's still a lot of new natural gas and coal going in. And so how do you get the wind and solar more preference than these other technologies to really change the entire energy infrastructure? And that's the big challenge.
Professor William Mumma dissected the policy and structural issues.
Without overall policy directions, it's very difficult.
to get everybody moving in the same direction. Coal is not cheap because basically we're paying huge costs for the use of coal. Economies, particularly in developing countries, are just having their economies devastated by having to pay for oil with hard currency, and the price of that keeps fluctuating upward and downward and very high, and is devastating these economies. And none of that is taken into account when we say that these fuels are cheap. On top of this, the industries themselves have been making a mighty effort to sow a lot of disinformation about climate change, making it very difficult to get any kind of a political agreement. And finally, one of the wonderful things about the proposal that Mark and his co-workers have made is that solar and wind, for example, are brought to you for free. And the scale of them is huge. There's 8,000 times as much solar energy hitting the Earth as we use in commercial energy every year. There's perhaps 12 times as much wind energy that can be harnessed on the Earth compared to what we use. And every place in the world has access to some natural energy flow that can fuel their economies. And that would greatly reduce conflict and go a long way towards alleviating poverty in the world. And yet, government after government is defending the status quo, as one diplomat said, long after the quo has lost its status. We need to figure out how to make this be seen as opportunities rather than as a problem.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle and The Insiders, Insight into Today's Most Pressing Issues. I'm Maria Armudian, and we are revisiting the highlights of 2012 and what we've learned from the scholars of The Scholar Circle. In August, we revisited the conflict in Syria. Professor Mark Levine assessed its history and its most important dynamics as follows.
The single most important international dynamic is that the United States and its P5 allies in the Security Council have made sure that the UN Security Council will never lose its veto. And as long as there's a veto that the P5 have, then this will continue to go on in Syria and wherever any other country, whether it's Israel, Palestine, or Iran, or anywhere else where there are clients at stake that these P5 members do not want to see harmed or defeated. We can't really do anything about Syria because we can't get the international community to act with one voice. So the world community as a whole really needs to push for a restructuring of the Security Council so that these major powers lose their veto, other countries get a bigger stake, a broader Security Council with more permanent members who can add a broader set of voices to the discussion. I think to focus too much on the international dimension is to do an injustice to the fact that millions and millions of Syrians got tired of 4 decades of acting, in the words of one of our colleagues, Miriam Cook, as if they lived in a country that had a ruler that should be obeyed, that was actually beneficent and all-powerful, as if there was some kind of justice, and as if they actually had a choice, when in fact they were living under a ruthless regime, and they decided they were willing finally to die to change this. And, you know, no matter what kind of imperial conspiracies you want to discuss them, which, you know, are certainly true to a certain degree, it still doesn't deny the fact that there are millions and millions of Syrians who've had enough of living under a brutal regime and are willing to die to be free, and we're for months and months trying to do it nonviolently. And we're really frustrated in many ways from doing that, while all the drug dealers of the world, or armed-slash-drug dealers, meaning the U.S., the Saudis, the Qataris, and others, we're starting to feed them precisely the weapons that would make this an even bigger bloodbath instead of helping them maintain a disciplined, nonviolent resistance, which was causing many, many defectors and was actually gaining ground before it so seamlessly morphed into a violent civil war.
Professor Nader Hashemi added the changing dynamics in the region, particularly within the Muslim religion.
With the American invasion and occupation of Iraq, the coming to power of Shi'i political parties in Iraq that are sympathetic or allied with the Islamic Republic of Iran, the regional balance of power shifted. Saudi Arabia, Egypt under Mubarak, what are often referred to as those moderate Arab states, were deeply upset at the fact that Iran had extended and is extending its influence in the region, and it perceived the situation in Iraq as a net gain for Iranian influence and the extension of its power throughout the Middle East. What the Saudis and the Gulf Cooperation Council state, they're trying to readdress that balance of power. They're hoping that if they can overthrow Iran's longtime ally in the region, the Assad regime in Syria, that they can compensate effectively for the loss of Iraq and thus diminish Iran's power in the region by doing so. Turkey is an important player in the region. I think it's playing a very important role in terms of events that we're seeing in the Arab Spring broadly, but particularly with respect to Syria. Turkey is effectively allied with the Saudis and the Gulf Cooperation Council states. It's provided a safe haven for not only refugees, but for the political opposition in Syria to gather, to organize. And this is the influx of arms coming in from Turkey into Syria is an important dimension as well. But also, on the plus side, I would also emphasize that the Justice Development Party in Turkey, in Ankara, is acting as a role model for many of these emerging social movements that are religious-based in nature, that are Islamist-based in nature, and they're looking at the example of Turkish politics and saying that that's our model of mixing religion, democracy, and politics for the future of the Arab world.
There are other dynamics aside from religion and ethnic division. Professor Rochelle Davis explains.
I don't think it's just about religion and sectarian issues. It's much, much more complicated than that. It isn't that black and white. It isn't about what religion you are, therefore that is going to decide what allegiance it is. It's much more about your role in Syria. It's about class. It's about economic things. It's about urban versus rural locales. It's about people's individual feelings and ideologies and experiences. So you have families that are split, whatever religion they are. You have some parts of some family that are with the regimes and parts of the same family that are against the regime. Syria has this incredible diversity of religions and ethnicities. One of the things that has made it unique and that I think that people fear that it will lose in the civil war is that tolerance and openness and inclusivity of everyone involved, everyone in Syria, to be part of the country, to be part of who Syrians are. That's different than how the regime constructed its power base. So I'm not saying that the regime itself was necessarily that way, but Syria certainly was an inclusive place. It wasn't that it tolerated you for who you were, it's that who you were was a fundamental part of the country itself. It also was fairly repressive of the Kurds, but that has been a card that they now seem to be playing with Turkey.
During the election season, we explored the factors that drive voters to cast their votes, the role of negative advertising, voter suppression, and the important role of third parties in America's history.
The last third party to rise up and become a major party was the Republican Party, and that took civil war. It was a complete disjuncture within the party system at the time that created this opportunity for a third party. But we haven't had that happen since. Every third party has been short-lived since that time. And there's rules and election rules and laws that are in place that have helped to create two-party dominance. Most specifically, we have a type of election in this country for the legislatures. It's called a single-member district with a plurality rule, which means whoever gets the most votes wins. And under those election conditions, right, there will only be two dominant parties. So the only chance a third party would ever have under the current election format is to try to replace one of the major parties. But then we'd be back to a two-party system.
Omar Ali?
Certainly in the latter part of the 20th century, just the issue of ballot access. So, for instance, if you want to run as a third-party candidate and get on the ballot in all 50 states, it requires something like 20 times the number of signatures than if you're a Democrat or a Republican. And the reason why is because the legislators, the Democrats and Republicans in office, write the election laws to basically keep themselves in power. They do that in other ways. For instance, the ways that, districts are formed, every 10 years, the redistricting is done on partisan lines. It's not done in some sort of logical way, again, to favor one or the other major party. You have the issue of primaries or closed primaries, which basically lock out independents in something like half of the states right now. So there are a number of ways in which the two major parties create rules and regulations to keep themselves in power. So that's a problem, and most people aren't aware of that unbelievable kind of discrimination that's going on. Basically, anybody who's not in a third party, essentially, they have to deal with a set of laws that make them effectively a second-class citizen. In the law, there really is a second-class status for independents and third-party candidates, and the reason why you don't hear about most of them is because it takes enormous resources for them to be in any way competitive. So we heard about Ross Perot in 1992, but he put in $70 million of his own money. But the Democratic and Republican parties start off their national campaigns with $50 million taxpayer money each. So the regular person or even a smaller third party has no way of competing in a meaningful way.
This is David Gillespie. I think it would be very important to point out that what we really have in contemporary America is not so much a free-flowing two-party system. That existed in the 19th century. What we have now is a duopoly, and I mean by that an imposed two-party system in which the ideal for the architects of that system, and I don't mean that in any conspiratorial sort of way, but just in the natural order of power holders using power for themselves, the ideal is to eliminate all third parties entirely. I think the single-member district is probably the principal reason why we have two parties. I can't say that that institution was instituted for the purpose of discrimination, because single-member district is older than what most democracies use today, which is the PR system, and which is conducive to a multi-party system.
After the election, we examine lawmaking in gridlock in the face of extreme polarization. Sean Theriault.
The book that I published had it going all the way up until Barack Obama was elected president, looking at data. And what we see there is the Democrats moving to the left and the Republicans moving to the right. But even since then, the polarization has grown much, much more as a consequence of the Tea Party. It's not only the Tea Party, but it's the fact that a lot of those Tea Party Republicans who were elected in 2010 were replacing moderate Democrats. And so as a consequence of those blue dogs losing to Tea Party folks, the Democratic Party has now even swung more to the left, and the Republicans, with the presence of the Tea Party folks, have swung even more to the right. The parties in Congress now act much more as teams than they used to before. We could imagine that the Democrats and Republicans could get together on some public policy issues, and there would be a significant crossover by a subset of one of the parties joining the other folks to enact real solutions to real problems. What we see now is if minority party members even think of crossing the party line to vote with the majority party to enact some type of policy change, they're merely giving the majority party more ammunition to use against them in the next election. And so the leaders of both parties are trying very hard to keep all of their members in complete opposition to whatever the majority party wants to propose. And when you have these institutions with different majorities, you can appreciate the problems that there is in passing legislation. Republicans in the House have a set idea of how we should create more jobs in the United States, and they pass bill after bill after bill. I mean, John Boehner will tell you that they passed 30 job bills in the last Congress. But, of course, none of those are taken up in the Senate because Harry Reid and the Democrats can't give the Republicans an issue that they can use against them in the next election. And the same is true with the Democrats in the Senate. They will pass bills that will never see the light of day in the House.
This is Mark. If I could add to that, when you've got parties like this in this divided ideological situation, it's really emphasizing the fact that the only thing that matters is which party wins the majority. And so anything that could be done in a way that would disadvantage one party over the other going into the next election becomes untenable.
In November, labor unions across Europe staged mass protests as joblessness in Europe rose to double digits across several European countries. We explored the roots of the European crisis. Professor Karl Kaltenthaler explained.
The crisis has its roots in a couple of different things that go back several years. You had a housing bubble develop, and that housing bubble burst, just as it did here, causing some very negative effects in the economies of several of the European countries, more Ireland, Spain, some others. Other countries have suffered from being basically the recipients of a lot of loans that at the time when they took those loans seemed like good bets for them. There was good growth going on in Europe. Interest rates were low. So you had governments like the Greek government borrow a lot of money. They figured they'd be able to pay it back. But then the economic crisis of 2008 hit and growth dipped substantially in Europe. And a lot of these governments began to suffer from an inability to pay back the loans. The problem was that growth dipped, their markets for exports dipped, And markets started to really worry about the Greeks and other governments' ability to pay back loans. And the financial crisis became an economic crisis, which then became a fiscal crisis in the sense that governments went to the international markets to borrow money so that they could pay their basic necessities, pensions, infrastructure, public employees, things like that. And it soon became a problem that the debt that they had run up was so great that they couldn't pay back the creditors. So they borrowed money from this troika of the European Central Bank, the European Commission, and also the International Monetary Fund, which isn't a European institution. The German government gave quite a bit of money to bail out these various indebted European governments. The Germans and other governments that gave money as well said that if we give this money, we expect austerity measures to be put in place. So governments that got this money cut down on how much money they were spending so that they could get themselves back in the black instead of the red. This has led to some real belt tightening on the part of many of these southern European governments. Lots of people have been let go who were employed by the government, which is ratcheting up the unemployment problem right as demand is going down because of a second global slowdown. So now you've got a situation in some countries like Spain and Greece where you've got 25% unemployment, and it's actually 50% if you just look at youth unemployment, and the government there are being asked to spend even less. So it looks as if there'll be even more unemployment. So in response, these unions that we see striking are sending a message to their governments, and they're sending a message to the European level as well, saying, look, we've had it with these austerity measures. They're just too tough on the people. Austerity is actually cutting down the growth that these governments need in order to generate revenue to be able to pay back the creditors. From the union's perspective, not only are people being hurt by the austerity, but they're actually hurting the government's ability to get themselves out of this fiscal hole that they've got.
Toward the end of the year, the world witnessed a second war between Israel and Gaza. Psychology professor Irvin Staub explained how the conflict escalated.
In the case of Israel and Palestine, what started out was a conflict over land. But when conflicts don't get resolved, over time they become intensely psychological, so that each party comes to see the other as responsible, as morally bad, mistrust develops, and especially when violence enters, there is an evolution of increasing hostility. In most forms of violence, when there are no constraining factors, people learn by doing. Individuals and groups change as a result of their own actions. And they also change when there is reciprocal violence, when the other group responds with violence. So the hostility, the negativity increases over time, which makes resolution extremely difficult. Another very important thing is that each group tends to hold a destructive ideology, a vision for the group that would provide something positive for the group, but that identifies another group standing in the way. In the case of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, many Israelis, not all, but a substantial number, hold on to a vision of Greater Israel, to recreating the historical Greater Israel. The Palestinians living in the West Bank are in the way. That's part of the territory of Greater Israel. For the Palestinians, many of them hold on to the old historical view of a Palestine that is a complete country, and the existence of Israel stands in the way of their vision of Palestine. So also historical wounds, victimization, suffering on the part of a group makes the world look dangerous and makes them feel vulnerable. And so other groups are potential enemies, and they are likely to strike out against these others because they believe they need to do that to defend themselves. One of the challenges over time is that woundedness could lead to a feeling of vulnerability and moving towards healing. And sometimes people, as they heal, their heart opens to others who suffer, and they are likely to be more caring about others. But woundedness in these cases, both for Israelis and Palestinians, became covered by a hard shell. We need to protect ourselves in the case of Israelis. We need to fight for our rights in the case of Palestinians. So there isn't the kind of openness that woundedness potentially could create.
Education professor Sami Adwan helped us understand how the conflict is bolstered through historical narratives in school textbooks.
In any societies engaging opposition and conflict, both society focus its own narrative. It's always legitimate and it's always right. And the other side is hardly mentioned in the other side textbooks. So there's so much focus on the self and so much denial on the others. We found in both schools' books, Palestinian and Israeli, there's a high level of delegitimization of each other. From the other side, you can find the dehumanization of the others in different forms. And the historical peaceful coexistence between Palestinian and Israelis hardly mentioned in both sides' textbooks. To say the least, that each side textbooks fail to include in its content any kind of information related to the other side. The children of both sides feeling that the other side doesn't exist at all, or there is no place for him or her. Denial, dehumanization, delegitimization, and demonization is the main characteristics of both sides.
Professor Adwan is working with Israeli professors to develop a new textbook that would help each side understand the other.
We recruited Palestinian and Israeli teachers. Both sides start writing how they narrate their histories, and we put it together. So we put the Balfour Declaration from the Israeli side, how it's been seen from the Palestinian side, the 1948 war, the 1967, the peace accord. So we put these two narratives opposite to each other in a way to allow children in both sides and teachers and communities and parents to know there is different narrative besides my own. How to deal with these issues, how to create a discussion between yourself and your narrative in the light of the existence and recognition of the other side narrative. We'd like to educate children as much as we can that in the other side there's a human part. It's not all enemy. We continue to train teachers because teachers are the emissaries of their narrative. Teaching history is not an objective presentation of the past. It comes with a human and emotional aspect.
How can the conflict be resolved? Irvin Staub.
A really important thing is external bystanders seriously engaging. They can exert important influence to get people within the country to begin to move in certain directions. The United States, American Jews, Arab countries. Ideally, they should form some kind of a coalition on the outside to engage not only in the political realm, but in order to exert an influence to generate internal constructive leadership.
Sami Adwan.
To deal with the future, we have to deal with the historical narrative.
We entered the holiday season with a look at the so-called Christmas truce, when men in the front lines of World War I, one of the most destructive wars in history, laid down their arms and instead played soccer with the very people they were supposed to be killing. These were just some of the highlights of the Scholar Circle in 2012. I'd like to thank our producers, Ankine Ahasyan, Melissa Chiprin, assistant producer Ishmael Karim. Most of all, thank you for listening. You can always go back to kpfk.org or to scholarcircle.org to hear any piece that you missed. You can always podcast us, follow us on Twitter at Armudian. And with that, Happy New Year.